This is Susan Livingston reporting for Sequitur for Expressions of Peace Radio. Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. With habitat loss, ecological collapse, and consequent impending extinction as its main themes, Sequitur is a discussion of the natural consequences of actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zympht. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. You can find more of his music on SoundCloud. Sequitur evolved from the Global Extreme Weather segment on Extinction Radio, which was conceived as a project of the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group on Facebook. Sequitur's purpose is to provide witness to extinction events and their drivers for the whole web of life, not just to extreme weather events and natural disasters, and not just when they involve property destruction and loss of human life or monetized livelihood. Aho, mitakwe oasin, we are all related. Last time, I played an excerpt about so-called sustainability from an interview of conservation biologist and climate science researcher Dr. Guy McPherson by my colleague Peter Melton, musician, event organizer, and peace activist extraordinaire. I also announced that Guy McPherson's podcast, Nature Bats Last, would return to the Progressive Radio Network on Tuesday, 20 September. Well, through no fault of Guy's, the latter didn't happen, so this time, for all you Jones and NBL fans, Sequitur will feature the rest of that interview about our great unraveling, mercilessly edited down from 90 minutes to 3 segments that total about 40 minutes. And I'll be interjecting news items, announcements, and cultural enhancements between, before, and after the interview segments. In part one, Guy and Peter talk about the loss of habitat and species diversity that characterized the sixth mass extinction event, which is now officially underway. For example, Bolivia's Lake Pawpaw, formerly habitat to a diversity of fish and birds and a source of livelihood for hundreds of people, has been reduced to a wasteland in just 3 years, reports the Weather Channel. But first, before we get into the science...
Hee-haw! It's Benjamin the Donkey. How do you get through to people? You know, I think it's probably like church. Keep repeating the litany of our cult until we believe it. To get an idea what is meant by these words which could cause discontent, why don't we cavort through the real import of extinction-level event? A dead end in Darwin's descent, which humans and others lament. We'll lose all we've won. It's gone, finished, done, an extinction-level event. Think extinct, 100%. Defunct, wrecked, kaput, shot, and spent. We're too maladjusted, we're broken, screwed, busted from extinction-level event. It's my view you're free to dissent, but I think that we can't circumvent, never more to awake. It's baked in the cake, this extinction-level event. So accept what we cannot prevent. It's over, sunk, fixed in cement. Let's get through our head. It means we're all dead. Our extinction-level event. Hee-haw!
And now, here's Guy McPherson in conversation with Peter Melton.
As the delicate web of life starts getting torn apart, this brings up this quest I have to try to look for signposts. What are some of the things that are already clear signs that the web is being torn and our system can't go on?
Yeah, you know, there's that wonderful episode from the HBO program, The Newsroom, from November 2014, written by Aaron Sorkin, in which the EPA scientist is brought into the newsroom. And he goes off script quite a bit and starts talking about abrupt climate change. And he just freaks out the anchor on the show. And finally, the anchor asks him, so what is all this going to look like? And the guy responds with a whole bunch of things that are already happening. So what's this going to look like? Food and water shortages? Well, click both of those off. I mean, one of the biggest cities in the world, Buenos Aires, doesn't have access to decent water anymore. And there are individual examples throughout the world now of people not having access to potable water. Food supplies? We have people fleeing Africa and several island nations in the South Pacific because there's no more habitat for humans in those places. And that brings up another issue. We have a refugee crisis. People are leaving places like those islands in the South Pacific and interior Africa. They're leaving them because there is no habitat anymore. And then another thing he mentions is fires, wildfires, too numerous and too large to control. And you only have to look as far as Canada and Australia and even the United States. Last year, 2015, there were more acres burned than in any other time in recorded history in the United States. More acres burned from wildfires. And then finally, the thing he mentions is storms that have the power to level cities and create permanent darkness. Well, the darkness isn't permanent yet, but most people remember Typhoon Haiyan that struck the Philippines in 2013. And most people remember Hurricane Sandy. And almost everybody in the United States probably remembers Katrina that struck New Orleans and did create darkness for a long time. It wasn't permanent, but it's easy to imagine with the storms that have been on the rise and are truly catastrophic, it's pretty easy to imagine that at some point they do create permanent darkness. So all of those things are underway. They are not something that we need to worry about in the distant future.
This mentality that because the planet has been so stable for this window of time that humanity's been able to grow big brains, and we take it all for granted, of course.
Of course. Been like this, it's always going to be like this.
Right.
You know, we're human animals at our core, and like every other animal, we need habitat to survive. And without habitat, we aren't going to make it just like any other species.
Right. And this is where some folks get into the argument around, well, you know, it's not going to wipe us out entirely. There'll be pockets of places where people might live. Or, of course, there's the bunkers. Some of the people are in bunkers, but it's not like the old storm shelter where, you know, a day later you come out and everything's the same.
That's right. Ultimately, we have to get at the point of habitat that is key to this, to our continued persistence on the planet. And we are capable of destroying habitat for ourselves. And we have been doing that for a long time, just like we're capable of destroying habitat for other species. Almost no species goes extinct because we shoot it to death. And that's not going to happen with humans. We're going to run out of habitat for our species, just as we caused to happen for many other species.
And other signposts, you talk about species die-off.
Right. You know, the United Nations put out this report in August 2010, indicating that 150 to 200 species are estimated to be driven to extinction every day. And we cannot disrupt this web of life and expect that there will be no consequences for the primary disruptor.
Right. This number, 150 to 200 a day, has there been other reports that you've seen that talk about any more recent updated numbers?
I haven't seen more updated figures. What I do see frequently is academic conservation biologists who are pretty conservative by their nature because they're in academia and they're scientists. So there's two strikes against them right there. So they talk mostly about the rate at which species are going extinct relative to the quote background rate. So before industrial civilization showed up or before any form of civilization showed up, the rate of speciation was slightly in excess of the rate of extinction. It had to be, or we wouldn't have all these species around.
Right.
We wouldn't have this vibrant earth with literally millions of species surrounding us. So throughout all of Earth's history, with six exceptions, speciation rates have exceeded extinction rates. And now what academic conservation biologists are reporting is extinction rates that are far in excess of speciation rates, far in excess of, quote, background rates, 100 to 1,000 times greater than the speciation rate. And so that's why, finally, the peer-reviewed literature caught up with reality in a paper in Science Advances last year, pointing out that the sixth great extinction is underway.
Gotcha.
So we're in the midst of this sixth mass extinction or great extinction event. So now we're in the sixth time that extinction rates have exceeded speciation rates.
Thank you for clarifying that more. That's so hard to grasp, 100, 200 species a day dying. because we don't understand, like you said, that there's billions of species, that many of them are microbial. And you start talking about pollinators being in trouble and the effect that that grows out to and the decayers.
Right. You know. They're the little things that really matter. They're the things that provide nitrogen in an available form for plants so that we have plants to eat. They're the things that decompose the dead material so that it gets turned into soil and so on. So those are the little things that really matter. But what we know about are the things we see in the zoos, things we eat, or that we see on our walk. You know, we know dogs and cats, cows, and asparagus.
Right. So much of it are these little things that are kind of outside of our radar, but not to a conservation biologist who understands. Tell us more about, like you were saying, the pollinators and the decayers.
Right. So a classic example that has received attention lately, Chernobyl was, what, 30 years ago?
86, when, I think so.
Yeah. So now, just within the last few years, one of the documented consequences of that rapid release of ionizing radiation, the trees are all still standing in the local area. Why is that? The trees should fall down. It's been 30 years. And they're essentially all dead now, but they won't fall over because there's no decomposers to eat them. So they're called ghost trees. They might as well be made of concrete. Wood will last a really, really long time if there's nobody to eat it, if there's no organisms to chew it out. This gets right at the base of ecological activity within that system. If those trees don't fall down and then get churned back into soil, become part of this continuous wave-like biological activity by which the dead contribute to the birth of living things, it stops the whole show.
Right.
And now we don't have carbon and nitrogen going into the soil anymore. It's just sitting there above ground. And pollinators, you know, the bees of the world are in what's called colony collapse disorder. The colonies are collapsing. So it's one of those rare cases when the scientific term actually makes sense and is intuitive. So the colonies are collapsing, and especially in North America. Albert Einstein never said this, but people attribute this quote to him. Without bees to pollinate, then 4 years later, there will be no humans. Those pollinators provide an enormous amount of the transformation of the flower to the fruit. And the fruit is what we eat. At its root, pretty much everything we eat is plants or things that eat plants. And there's many, many ways that industrial civilization contributes to the decline of the biological activity that is carried out by those organisms. So, you know, if you change the proportion of heavy metals in the soil, for example, that impacts negatively the ability of microbes to convert nitrogen from a form that is not available to plants to a form that is available for plants. In the Intermountain West, where I live, the primary limiting factor on plant productivity is water. So no big deal. We'll just add water. We'll take it out of the nearby river or pump it out of the ground and put it on the plants, and then we can grow the plants. Okay, that works until we reach another limiting factor. And almost always the second most limiting factor in this region and throughout the Northern Hemisphere, in fact, is nitrogen. It's not because there's not lots of nitrogen out there. There is. There's an abundance of nitrogen, even in the soil, but it's not in a form that is available for plants to uptake. So there's various forms of nitrogen, nitrites, nitrates, ammonium, but most of it in the soil is not available to plants. How do you convert it from one form to another? Bring on the microbes. These little tiny things, that's what they do. They get their energy by converting nitrogen from one form to another and stripping off a little of the stuff they need to survive. These microbes are tremendously important, just like the pollinators and the decomposers are tremendously important.
Right. And that's that base of how we grow food. I know I've heard people say in talks and whatnot, well, you know, we'll just plant different foods in this area if these foods don't grow. And theoretically, yes, you could dig a hole and put a seed and water and whatnot. But if the bees don't come to pollinate or the other microbes aren't there to do their thing, you know, it turns out that the small stuff is really important.
Absolutely. Especially when we're talking about the scale that we're talking about today. You know, sure, we could hand pollinate plants. We could. We don't need no stinking bees anymore. We could go out there with Q-tips and pollinate every plant we want pollinated. We could pollinate the peach trees and the plum trees. We could pollinate the whole thing and provide enough food for ourselves. But only if everybody had a bunch of Q-tips and was willing to go out there many hours every day and pollinate their own food.
Wow.
Biologically, you know, that the species we drive to extinction are not limited to land species. These things are connected, as always. I saw a pretty decent documentary film recently called Dam Nation. And it featured a little bit from Edward Abbey, something you don't see in contemporary films since he died 27 years ago, about Glen Canyon Dam. And it showed these guys kayaking and trying to get through the lock system at these big dams. They're on the Columbia River, which has probably among the best developed system of locks anywhere in the world. And they wouldn't let them through. The Department of Homeland Security people said, no, you can't ride in a kayak through here. And the two guys in the kayaks cited them chapter and verse of the law that said they could. And then they got chased away by the Department of Homeland Security because they weren't shipping something. So the whole system has come to be associated with shipping, and most notably shipping grain from the interior of North America out to the ocean. And the lock system is necessary because it's all dammed up to allow the transfer of those grains from one spot to another. But one of the consequences of that is you no longer have salmon going to places that they went for hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of years. And if you do, you have far fewer than you used to. It's the theory of unintended consequences, right? So we built this lock system so that we could carry goods and in some cases services up and down this extensive river system. We're just looking out for ourselves after all. And it turns out that we muck it up so badly that we threaten our own existence by taking a bunch of other species down the tubes.
A study of 22 watersheds in western Washington state attributes the continuing decline of salmon populations to more paving that prevents water uptake by the land and sends polluted runoff into streams, loss of an additional 153 square miles of forest cover, and new shoreline modifications, reports the Olympian. Quote, recommended actions include placing a moratorium on development permits until standards are revised to prevent habitat destruction, completing new water quality rules to protect both human and fish health, improving stormwater management to reduce the flow of toxics into streams and Puget Sound, and taking actions that ensure there is enough cool, clean water in streams when fish need it. Although the report doesn't directly address it, urban planning and growth management are key to these efforts, creating denser, more walkable cities that people can afford to live in is critical to reducing the suburban sprawl that is a leading cause of habitat loss, unquote. In part two, Guy and Peter will zoom out for the big picture view of the oceanic and atmospheric changes that are taking place on our planet. A few weeks ago, I featured survey results that showed that climate change is a far greater concern of the American public than previously supposed. It depends on how the survey questions are framed. Another factor is the sampling demographic. In an online poll for the Guardian's Voices of America project, only a small percentage of their readership denied that climate change was a major problem. Phasing out fossil fuel, expansion of renewable energy, the unfolding disaster affecting coral and other marine life, deforestation, and climate refugees ranked highly, but took a back seat to sea level rise and food and water shortages. But to what extent is the Guardian's readership representative of American citizens? Especially in this election season, I feel called to remind you of what's really important. And toward that end, before we return to Guy and Peter, I offer the following cultural enhancement. The Invitation by Oriah Mountain Dreamer. It doesn't interest me what you do for a living. I want to know what you ache for, and if you dare to dream of meeting your heart's longing. It doesn't interest me how old you are. I want to know if you will risk looking like a fool for love, for your dream, for the adventure of being alive. It doesn't interest me what planets are squaring your moon. I want to know if you have touched the center of your own sorrow, if you have been opened by life's betrayals, or have become shriveled and closed from fear of further pain. I want to know if you can sit with pain, mine or your own, without moving to hide it or fade it or fix it. I want to know if you can be with joy, mine or your own, if you can dance with wildness and let the ecstasy fill you to the tips of your fingers and toes without cautioning us to be careful, to be realistic, to remember the limitations of being human. It doesn't interest me if the story you are telling me is true. I want to know if you can disappoint another to be true to yourself, if you can bear the accusation of betrayal and not betray your own soul, if you can be faithless and therefore trustworthy. I want to know if you can see beauty even when it's not pretty, every day, and if you can source your own life from its presence. I want to know if you can live with failure, yours and mine, and still stand on the edge of the lake and shout to the silver of the full moon, yes. It doesn't interest me to know where you live or how much money you have. I want to know if you can get up after the night of grief and despair, weary and bruised to the bone, and do what needs to be done to feed the children. It doesn't interest me who you know or how you came to be here. I want to know if you will stand in the center of the fire with me and not shrink back. It doesn't interest me where or what or with whom you have studied. I want to know what sustains you from the inside when all else falls away. I want to know if you can be alone with yourself and if you truly like the company you keep in the empty moments. You are listening to Sequitur on Expressions of Peace Radio. Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived at panina.org, that's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action.
What are the signposts that were taking apart the delicate web? I wanted to hit on the ocean. You know, what do we see when we look at the ocean?
Yeah, we see a mess. We see the Great Pacific Gyre, this enormous garbage patch that's in what used to be a blue ocean. We're in one of the three major coral bleaching events in recorded history, and it appears that it'll be the worst one ever, and that's because the ocean is hot. In addition, the ocean is acidic. As carbon dioxide increases in the atmosphere, some of it goes directly into the atmosphere and spends all its life there, but some of it doesn't. Some of it gets absorbed by the ocean. And as it gets absorbed by the ocean becomes more acidic. It becomes more like carbonic acid and less like seawater. And in fact, the first Referee Journal article about the topic of warming of the planet was by a guy named Svante Arrhenius. It was published in April of 1896, and the title included the word carbonic. He talked about carbonic acid of the atmosphere because he recognized that by pouring all this carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, we're going to acidify the atmosphere and therefore acidify the rain that comes out of the sky. And the ocean is taking up all this rain and taking up some cases directly from the atmosphere, all this carbon dioxide, and becoming more acidic. Well, every species on the planet persists in a very narrow range of biological conditions. We have this increased acidification that is probably responsible for these huge algal blooms. As I've indicated many times, and so have many other climate scientists, it's difficult to attribute a single event to overall climate change. But we're seeing a whole lot more of these kinds of events than we saw before. We're seeing not only coral bleaching, but lots of these algal blooms in places that they didn't used to occur or didn't used to be this large. So not only are we throwing our trash into the ocean, but we're inadvertently throwing our carbon dioxide into the ocean and changing the physical conditions. When you change physical conditions, the biological organisms are going to suffer, or the matrix of organisms living there is going to change. But the changes are happening so quickly, the acidification is happening so quickly, that organisms just can't keep up. If these changes were occurring over temporal spans of hundreds of thousands of years, it might not be such a big deal, because organisms could adapt through natural selection. But we now know, based on the Referee Journal literature, that the pace of change already, even at the relatively linear rates of change through the early 2000s, the rate of change exceeds the ability of organisms to adapt by evolution through natural selection by a factor of 10,000 times. So we can't just expect to acidify the ocean a little tiny bit and have no important consequences. It just doesn't work that way. You know, even humans persist within a relatively narrow range Our time on the planet has been spent between 12 degrees and 17 degrees Celsius, planetary average temperature. That's a pretty narrow range. And I suspect the primary reason we have persisted within that 5-degree range is because the organisms we depend upon persist within that relatively narrow range of conditions. So we are not going to go to hothouse Earth, 22 degrees Celsius overall planetary average. We're not going to go to hothouse Earth in a decade or two and expect humans to survive, simply because the organisms we depend upon can't keep up. They can't keep up already, and we're in the early stages of abrupt climate change.
Talk about the plankton. What's going on with the plankton?
Plankton, in some places, have had their populations decline by 40%. Plankton form the base of the marine food web. So if you're going to reduce your diet by 40%, it's going to have consequences. And that's basically what we're doing in various parts of the ocean. There's a recent paper in the Refereed Journal Literature, again, these are very conservative sources, indicates that we could lose all the plankton in the ocean, all of them, because the changes are occurring so rapidly. Well, that's half the food we eat and half the oxygen we breathe. That's the base of the marine food web, which is the source of approximately half of the food humans eat.
Yeah.
The land plants account for about half of our oxygen, and ocean plants, mostly phytoplankton, account for the other half.
Right. When there's less plankton, then the little fish are having to go different places to find it. And then the big fish have to go different places to find the medium fish. That really helped it come home to me when they were talking about the seal moms having to swim a whole lot further to try to find food. And then they don't make it back. Then you get all these pups who don't get fed, and then they wash up on shore.
Right. And you see it everywhere, especially in the organisms at the top or the end of the food chain, like polar bears that depend upon smaller animals. That depend upon smaller animals, that depend upon plants, that depend upon phytoplankton. So you start messing with the base of the food web, and it doesn't take long before consequences amplify in terms of the organisms at the top or the end of the food web. So yeah, that's absolutely right. There are consequences being felt already. I was recently interviewed for Press TV of Iran on the topic of ocean exploitation. You'd be hard-pressed to find somebody who is out there on a daily basis who hasn't noticed that the big fish are all gone. There was a fisherman who was presented with the information that 90% of the big fish have died within the last few decades. And he laughed and said, 90%? That's a dream. 99% at least.
Wow.
So the big fish are all gone. And it's been relatively gradual over human lifespans. So it used to be, you see the pictures of Ernest Hemingway catching that big marlin. And now a big marlin is a third that size.
Mm.
But it's occurred over the span of 60 years or so. So we sort of don't notice.
So here's those signs. We were talking about different signs that are already happening.
I have a friend in Tucson who has one of those placards in her kitchen. The type. Everybody's got a placard in their kitchen that is their philosophy of life. And one of her placards says, "The ocean fixes everything." And that's been our mentality, right? The ocean fixes everything. Just throw it in the ocean. And so far, that's actually worked. It doesn't matter whether you're a cruise ship or you're New York City or you're the sewage plant in Oklahoma or the crude oil fields in Edmonton. If you throw it in the ocean, it just goes away. Problem solved. But we know better, don't we?
We think so.
At some point, the ocean doesn't fix everything. Okay.
What seemed like a happy-go-lucky status quo maybe in the 50s or 60s has now spun itself into all these things we speak about. And perhaps the one that's easiest to really feel the pressure on is the ice cap. Let's talk about the Arctic.
It looks like we're headed for an open ocean free of ice in the not-too-distant future. In 1979, satellite measurements began by the U.S. government of ice extent. Before then, all we have is proxy records. We don't have direct measurements of how much ice was in the Arctic. But those proxy measurements indicate that beginning with the Industrial Revolution, beginning in 1750, more or less, the Arctic ice extents began to decline. Since 1979, it's down to about half of what it used to be. If you're an optimist, we still got half. But this is a great example of what's called tipping points. Sometimes half isn't enough. Sometimes when you only have half what you started with, the system is much more fragile than it used to be. Imagine two teams are playing in the Super Bowl, and one of the teams gets the full complement of 11 players, and the other one only gets 6. How's that going to work out?
Yeah.
And that ice is doing a lot of work, by the way, a lot more work than those 5 guys who just got pulled off the field. That ice in the Arctic is responsible for maintaining the relatively cool temperature that we have right now. In human history, in the entire span of the genus Homo, we have never had an ice-free Arctic. And according to the U.S. Naval Postgraduate College analysis done a few years ago, we could have an ice-free Arctic in 2016, plus or minus 3 years. And then a tweet, of all things, put out by the United States Geological Survey early in March, a tweet says, yeah, it looks like we're headed toward an ice-free Arctic this year. See, once you get down to half the ice you used to have, it's a lot easier to break up that ice. Most listeners have probably seen a snowy day, and the ground is completely covered with the snow. But if the snow is only 2 inches deep, it doesn't take long for all the snow to disappear. If the snow is 2 feet deep, that's a whole other thing. It's going to take a lot of sunny days to get rid of all that snow. And it's a similar situation in the Arctic. If indeed we experience an ice-free Arctic, then the really important stuff starts to happen. If we don't have ice, we will almost undoubtedly experience really rapid warming of the planet.
Well, I remember around Christmas time, but even since then.
Oh, yeah.
10, 20, 30, 40 degrees above normal?
Yes, the temperature anomalies have been in excess of 20 degrees Celsius in the Arctic on a pretty regular basis. And so mid-March, the ice extent is about 2 standard deviations below the average or normal. And at or almost at the lowest ever, 2012 and 2007 were years of catastrophic ice extent declines. And we're tracking or below those ice levels. So this is unbelievably serious stuff we're talking about here, because we've talked about, you know, as long as you have a little bit of ice left in your glass, the liquid in the glass will be at 0 degrees Celsius. But once that last little sliver of ice melts, then the glass of liquid will warm to room temperature in a matter of a few minutes.
Right. And so this open ocean or blue ocean event where the ice goes so low that there's none left, even if it's just for a day or a week or something, the amount of the albedo, right, the amount that the ocean is now sucking in instead of reflecting back is humongous. But also it's a lot harder for the snow then to clump together, as I understand it.
Yes. So there's two things going on. You mentioned albedo, which is the reflectivity of the ice that's there. So if you have a bunch of ice, you reflect back into space a bunch of the incoming sunlight. And there's also the concept of latent heat. If you have just a little bit of ice, it will keep the temperature of the water at 0 degrees Celsius. But once that last little bit of ice is gone, then the water itself will heat up quite rapidly. So there's albedo, the reflectance, and there's also the latent heat, or in this case, ability to maintain freezing temperatures. Two really important concepts. And the point is, without that ice to provide a little bit of cooling, the Arctic Ocean will warm up very, very rapidly.
What does this heating do, and does it make it harder for the ice to clump the next winter?
Yeah, I mean, it's a classic self-reinforcing feedback loop. The less ice there is at the beginning of the year, the less potential there is for ice to persist throughout the year and therefore have a base to build upon going into the next year. And it's not just Arctic ice. And it's not just methane. There's way more contributors to our near-term extinction than just those two phenomena that we've articulated in some detail over the course of the last few months and years. And so most people are familiar now with methane, although it was relatively little known as an atmospheric greenhouse gas as little as 5 or 10 years ago. There just wasn't much study of it. Now most people are familiar with its tremendous power to heat the planet in a short period of time. And most people are familiar with carbon dioxide and the importance of ice. But then there's moistening of the upper troposphere. So water vapor is actually the most abundant greenhouse gas. And the hotter it gets, the more water gets evaporated off. Well, of course, that's only logical.
So that's the atmosphere sucking the water from the land and the ocean?
Right. As it sucks the water from the ocean, it contributes to increased sucking of water from the ocean. So the more you put up there, the faster it's able to suck.
Right.
And so moistening it up in the troposphere by itself has the potential to increase global average temperature to about 1.5 degrees Celsius above baseline. I'm sure you never did this when you were a kid, but I heard stories about this happening. People taking a magnifying glass and killing ants with it, right? You know, you had to hold the thing at 4 or 5 inches above ground. Well, one of the recent technologies that's been proposed to enhance the ability of photovoltaic solar panels to capture energy, they're enormously inefficient when you just have them sitting up there on your roof. They don't capture very much of the incoming sunlight. So what people have proposed within the last decade or so is using magnifying glasses to concentrate the sun's rays onto the right part of the solar panel. Methane is the magnifying glass that the 8-year-old holds 4 or 5 inches above that ant and fries it in no time. Methane is what really, really exacerbates heating of the planet.
Yeah. And these are the big powerhouse parts of this collapsing system that are hard to even fathom at first take for a lot of people, that methane could be 100 times more powerful than CO2 and how that might heat things up 10 or 50 or 100 times faster.
Right. And in fact is far more powerful a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. But it's only come on the radar within the last few years. NBC actually ran a story about methane from the Arctic Ocean and how important it was as a greenhouse gas in 2007 or 2008. And now it seems like it's nowhere to be found.
Now, you started to talk about that as the ice melts. This is where the methane is. So let's go through that.
So we have methane hydrates or clathrates, little chemical cages around methane molecules. Methane is CH4. So we have one carbon atom and 4 hydrogen atoms collected together to make a molecule of methane. You probably know it as natural gas. Natural gas is comprised almost completely of CH4. And like carbon dioxide, it has the potential, when in the atmosphere, to trap long-wave radiation. In this case, methane, in the short term, has a potential to trap that is 100 times or more powerful than the trapping ability of carbon dioxide. It's difficult for me to imagine a scenario in which we don't have that 50 gigaton burst Natalia Shikova warns about being released from the Arctic. It's hard to imagine that doesn't happen when we have an ice-free Arctic.
We interrupt this program to bring you some important announcements.
The destination of this train is Brain 3.
The destination of this scientist is New Zealand. Yes, Kevin Hester is hosting another Guy McPherson New Zealand tour from 24 November through 7 December. The link to the Facebook announcement is on the Panina page for this podcast. A video crew is part of the entourage, and we are expecting a documentary film from the tour as well as the usual YouTube clips. Speaking engagements are still being organized and added to the itinerary, but here's what we've got so far. Thursday, 24 November, Gratitude Day in the United States. Interview on The Paul Henry Show on TV3, 6 to 9 a.m. Sunday, 27 November, keynote at Unitech Campus, Point Chevalier, Auckland, in the Gold Lecture Theater, 3 p.m. New Zealand time, 2 a.m. Greenwich Mean Time. In North America, that's Saturday, 26 November at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Kevin says there will be technical support for live stream technology for this event, so I look forward to being there even though I can't be there. Wednesday, 30 November, public meeting at the Mangarara Eco Lodge, Patangata, Otain, 6:30 p.m. Thursday, 1 December, presentation followed by Q&A and meet and greet at the Davis Lecture Theater, Whanganui Regional Museum, 6 p.m. The long-awaited return of Guy McPherson's podcast, Nature Bats Last, co-hosted with Mike Sliva, has been rescheduled for Tuesday of next week. That's the 4th of October. It's a live call-in show, so tune into Progressive Radio Network, that's PRN.FM, at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. You are listening to Sequitur on Expressions of Peace Radio. Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived at panina.org, that's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. According to a study of population responses to sea level rise in the melting Arctic between 1990 and 2014, by University of New Hampshire sociologist Lawrence Hamilton, published in Population and Environment, population is increasing even as the region comes under increasing threat, reports Alaska Dispatch News. The study examined demographics in 43 villages and found an overall increase from 29,000 to 36,000, entirely due to births, as the net direction of migration was away from the village. In Alaska, where school budgets are tied to population growth, The increase has been as high as 50%. Not even the 2008 recession put a damper on the increase. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers named 12 villages as candidates for relocation at a cost of hundreds of millions of dollars each, yet the president asked Congress for $400 million total. I invite you to do the math. The situation is complicated by the fact that relocation is not always a viable solution for villagers who derive almost 80% of their sustenance from land and sea. The Massachusetts Wicked Local reports that the cost of moving a single beach parking lot on Cape Cod is $3 million. Say what? Meanwhile, a real estate tycoon recently petitioned the Irish government to build a 2.7-kilometer seawall to protect his recently purchased golf resort. A golf resort? Your tax dollars at work. According to the United Nations, Tuvalu and Kiribati are likely to be underwater by mid-century, reports Radio New Zealand. While Foreign Affairs Minister Murray McCulley wants to focus on infrastructure investments that will allow the native populations to stay put, the Labour Party's Sua William Seo doesn't want refugees already in New Zealand to be sent back to an untenable situation. Seo says, quote, "They've got issues not just with climate change, but with population growth and waste," unquote. In part three of our feature presentation, Guy and Peter take the science out of the laboratory in the classroom and bring it into politics and the economy. Back to you, Guy.
Basically, this notion of a meandering jet stream that locked California into a drought for 4 years was a result of the temperature disparity between the Arctic and the equator breaking down. So if there's a big temperature difference between the Arctic and the equator, we tend to have the jet stream that pushes these zonal storms or frontal systems across the North American continent in a matter of a few days. And this is what it was like when I was a kid 50 years ago. Anytime a storm system blew through northern Idaho, it blew through very rapidly, and the storm ended up in New York 2 days later. It went across the whole continent in 3 days, 4 days. And now we have this meandering jet stream that produced the enormous snow amounts on the eastern seaboard the winter of 2014-2015, and at the same time produced the drought in California. And that's all because the disparity in temperatures between the Arctic and the equator has broken down. They're more similar now. And so that controls the flow of these large-scale systems for really long periods of time. Now we have temperatures that in the Arctic are so much higher than they've ever been before and coming a lot closer to being the same temperature as is being observed at the equator. And that prevents these zonal systems or frontal systems from blowing across the country, and we get locked into this meandering jet stream.
Yeah. Well, there's less ice, whatever. We don't understand what lies under that. And as you dig under and under, you find how important these variances are and what effect they have. What are some of the next signs that show up, besides, I guess, just increase of all this, that we're on track for trouble?
Yeah, one of them has great potential to influence what we just talked about, which is global dimming. So industrial activity kicks all these aerosols and sulfates up in the atmosphere to serve as something of an umbrella to keep us cool, paradoxically enough, while also producing those greenhouse gases that make us warm.
Right, you lock the burglar in the house.
Yeah, right. And so when industrial activity ceases, we stop putting those particulates up there into the atmosphere. And these are the ones that serve as a protective shield, as an umbrella, that reflect incoming solar radiation or sunlight back out into space. What happens if we stop doing that? And are there signs we're going to stop doing that anytime soon? In fact, there are. There's something called the Baltic Dry Index, which no longer has anything to do with the Baltic region and no longer deals only with dry goods, although it did when it first started. But in the mid-1980s, the Baltic Dry Index began to keep track of all raw materials that were shipped. So any piece of lumber, any pile of grain, any ingots of lead that go onto ships that go around the ocean contribute to what's called the Baltic Dry Index. The Baltic Dry Index, when it was established, was set at 1,000. It's just an index, so we can set it anywhere. And this is the mid-1980s. I think it was 1985. And whoever was in charge of the Baltic Dry Index said, this level of activity that the world is experiencing right now in shipping these goods around, we're going to call this 1,000. This is the baseline. And that'll give us plenty of potential for going up and plenty of potential for going down. In, I think it was May 20th, 2008, right before what most people call the beginning of the global financial crisis, the Baltic Dry Index hit its all-time high of almost 12,000. So what that means is shipping activity had increased just about 12 times compared to the mid-1980s. That was in 2008. That's 23 years. We have increased shipping of raw materials by about 12 times. That sounds like a big number, and it is. Where is it at now? The Baltic Dry Index is below 300. As nearly as I can tell, it's the index that can least be fudged. You know, the Federal Reserve System, the central banks around the world can actually pump things up like the stock market. So they can directly intervene by buying stocks and therefore pump up the Dow Jones Industrial Average. But I don't think they can mess with the Baltic Dry Index. I think that's actually a pretty good indicator of the shipping of raw materials around the globe. And if it's down below 300, the lowest it's ever been in history, that might be telling us that industrial activity is actually way, way down, contrary to what your government tells you about economic growth proceeding apace. The metric that is really difficult to fudge indicates that there's not a lot of movement of materials around the planet. So that's a sign.
Right.
Basically, what these greenhouse gases are doing, they are trapping the heat that has already entered the system. You know, industrial activity puts out a variety of particulates. Sulfates and aerosols are most notable for their ability to serve as an umbrella to block incoming sunlight or incoming radiation. And so, interestingly, industrial activity provides something of a shield against incoming sunlight, while at the same time producing carbon dioxide and methane and nitrous oxide and ozone, other greenhouse gases that actually trap the heat once it penetrates through that umbrella of sulfates and aerosols.
Right.
So it's a real mixed bag in a complicated system. It has taken climate scientists a long time to piece together a relatively rudimentary understanding of how that whole system works. You know, when Svante Arrhenius was writing in 1896 about carbonic acid in the atmosphere, I doubt he had any idea about the role of sulfates and aerosols in actually dimming the incoming radiation. So it's taken a long time to get these rudimentary pieces put together. And throughout that entire time, we've been the collective bull in the china shop that is just having a good time and looking for that cob of corn and what's all this stuff in my way.
Right. There's got to be a corn on the cob hiding in this china shop somewhere.
Right.
Yeah. So, boy, we've been talking for a while now about all the signs that are already here. There's so many trapdoors in the full system and the scale of what you're talking about, attempting to feed humanity and feeding another million mouths every 4.5 days or whatever that number is.
That's exactly right. So yes, we could tend our own garden, but then we wouldn't be at the shopping mall. We wouldn't be out buying a new car. We wouldn't be doing all those things that sustain civilization, that keep the economic growth engine going. And if you don't keep it going, it's going to crash. Civilizations grow or die. There's a bunch of relatively well-known folks and organizations pointing out that the system is seizing up. There's a paper in The Guardian in 2014 headlined something like, Limits to Growth was right. We're approaching the limits to growth, that the system actually cannot grow forever, that you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. I think that was July 2014. And then about 14 or 15 months later, the headline was something like, Limits to Growth was right. We're at the end, or we're near the end of the ability to grow. And then there's the former director of the regional Federal Reserve System. He basically said that the Fed is out of ammunition. There's nothing more that the Federal Reserve System can do. The system's coming down. So there are a bunch of people and organizations, as well as the metrics, indicating that industrial activity is at the very least slowing and that we're headed for something as bad or worse than the global financial crisis of 2008-2009. And the only way for that to get worse in terms of the economy is for the economy to completely cease operating. Well, if that happens, and as pointed out in June 2012 by a guy named David Korowicz, it's only 3 weeks, as little as 3 weeks, from the cessation of delivery of something important to the collapse of the whole house of cards.
Yeah.
Korowicz was focused on financial issues, and pointed out that if the debt-based financial system seizes up, if somebody can't get a loan to ship those goods, for example, then it could be as little as 3 weeks before the whole house of cards comes down. But I would argue the same thing applies to various other factors as well, that it's not just credit in the financial system. In the global financial crisis, 2008-2009, as one example, the United States sold all of its grain. So we no longer have any surplus grain. This is the equivalent of burning the furniture to stay warm in the winter. It gets you through the first winter. But then what? So now we have no surplus grain. And recently, the Northern Hemisphere exceeded the 2 degrees Celsius target limit for the entire Northern Hemisphere, the so-called political target of 2 degrees C beyond baseline that we could not cross. Well, that's really dangerous because that makes it very, very difficult to grow grains. So it could be as early as this fall that we have a disruption in wheat, oats, or corn significant enough to cause that disruption that Korowicz warned about in June 2012 and causes the whole house of cards to come down. That could happen.
Because that kind of disruption, like you mentioned with the food chain, but all with the food delivery, food growth, food delivery, food storage, any of these cards start to fall, or then there's not gas at the gas station, because don't the gas stations get filled up like every other night or something? Your gas station is getting new gas and the grocery stores are getting their new food. And any hint that things are off is going to create a run on the bank, a run on the grocery store, a run on the gas station in this mentality that we have. And then we got chaos going.
Yeah, you know, and that chaos could be literally just a few days away. You know, the typical big box grocery store has a 3-day supply, a 3-day inventory for what they sell every day. That's all they got. So if a run begins at the grocery store, if everybody decides, oh, there's some dire stuff going to happen, I'm going to go stock up on groceries, then it won't be a 3-day supply anymore. Mm-hmm. It'll be, you know, a 6-hour supply.
Right. And then when does the next load come and who's waiting to make sure they get all of that? And once again, these are used to being maybe 3-day supplies that now go in the first day. And then when can they get them again?
And then people start to panic and maybe they stop going to work. Even first responders stop responding and stay home with their families to provide production there after only a relatively short period of time.
Right.
So what if people stop going to their nuclear power plants? What if people stop going to the local water municipality? You know, and all of those systems require skilled, well-trained people to operate, to keep the water coming through the taps, to keep the food showing up at the grocery store, to keep the fuel in the filling station. You go into any big city and you walk up and down the streets where people are being fed in large numbers. So you see any restaurant and you look in the alley out back and you walk up and down the street and you wonder how this can be maintained for a week. It's been going on for years. You know, so the same restaurant, your favorite restaurant in, say, Los Angeles, has been operating for 60 or 70 years, always with this just-in-time delivery system, with the yeast coming in and the flour coming in and the baking soda coming in at just the right amount, at just the right time. There's never a disruption, so they're able to feed several hundred people every day that are dropping in. And it boggles the mind that we can keep that going for such a sustained period of time. Now, just imagine one disruption in that whole system. Right. So what we're talking about is closing the restaurant, and the restaurant is Earth. We sometimes talk about this game with wooden pegs called Jenga. You start with a structure, a solid structure, and then one player takes out one wooden peg from anywhere on the structure and puts it on top. And then the next player does the same thing. There's typically two players, and they take turns taking out a peg and putting it up on top. And the analogy should be clear. It's taking the bricks out from beneath the base of the building to build more floors up on top, to build a penthouse up on top. Mm-hmm. Well, at some point, you take out enough bricks, and this happens in Jenga every time, and the loser is the person who takes out the one that causes the whole thing to collapse. And every single time, at some point, the system becomes so fragile, you can't even remove one more peg or one more brick, and the thing collapses, and doesn't collapse slowly. It just goes down in a heap and makes this noise and everything. Yay, I won!
Right. but in the earthly game of Jenga, there's no winner.
There is no winner. That's right. And so we're taking out these pieces. We're taking out these species that we actually need for our own survival. And we're building penthouses with them and killing them along the way. And at some point, the whole thing is going to come down.
Tearing down forests to build mansions and wiping out oceans to build aquariums and all this on top of, like you say, this Jenga structure that's going higher and higher as we grow, and progress by tearing out the bricks that are holding it all up.
Right. It's absurd.
Terrific. I think we summed up the beauty of existence. Thank you. Good stuff.
Sure.
All right. Talk to you soon, buddy.
Take care of yourself, sir.
All right. Talk to you later.
See you soon.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Guy McPherson and Peter Melton, for that comprehensive overview of The Great Unraveling. A novel adaptation to Sea Level Rise might be Floating Cities, as envisioned by the Seasteading Institute. That's seasteading.org, a think tank for technologies, quote, to enable seasteading communities, floating cities, which will allow the next generation of pioneers to peacefully test new ideas for government. The most successful can then inspire change in governments around the world, close quote. For starters, they are negotiating within host country territorial waters, but the ultimate goal is the kind of autonomy that might speak to the needs of today's threatened island nations. Their mission is captured in 8 so-called moral imperatives: enrich the poor, cure the sick, feed the hungry, clean the atmosphere, restore the oceans, live in balance with nature, power the world sustainably, and stop fighting. Thanks for listening to Sequitur on Expressions of Peace Radio, and special thanks to Benjamin the Donkey for his limerick Extinction Level Event, to Peter Melton and Guy McPherson for their coverage of the evidence for near-term human extinction, and to Zimft for the Sequitur theme music. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston.
What connects us is one.